Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, a married man, Nate Langson.
And me, also a married man, Ian Morris.
And brought to you by you. Thank you, obviously, to our patrons supporting us every week at patreon.com/UKTech. This is your extended cut of this week's show if you're a patron. But if you're not and you'd like to get it, along with our weekly columns, one of which we're going to be talking about this week, head to patreon.com/UKTech to find out how you can support us. And thank you to some of our new patrons this week. Tom Edge, Alex Bailey, I believe, joined us this week. So thank you to you guys. Ian was on Tom Merritt, a friend of the show, DTNS, when following the wedding, because Tom Merritt was over here for the wedding. And
it was really good. And I'll tell you what, it's so different doing that show to how it is doing this show. I mean, the good thing about DTNS is that for the Patreons, you've got that kind of pre-show and post-show, which is quite good. But the show is so tight. It's like, you know, that there's not a lot of time to expand on stuff and you just have to get through it. It's quite good. And I completely lost my train of thought. It was the most embarrassing thing ever.
Well, I was listening to it, but I listened to it after the fact.
Yes.
Because I planned on listening to it on my honeymoon, but I believe I was in a hot tub drinking a whiskey and watching...
Looking at the stars,
and so I didn't...
Was it good, by the way? Did it, from a stargazing perspective, was your honeymoon everything you'd hoped for?
Oh, absolutely. You could see
it
the
wasn't cloudy or anything like that.
Most nights it was, but one night it very much wasn't. And
that's good. And you took a telescope.
We forgot the telescope.
Oh, how do you forget the telescope?
I know, it was a shame. We forgot the telescope. But it was, I mean, you could see the Milky Way banding across the sky.
Oh, so that's wicked. Like,
it was fantastic. It was great. Yeah. But I did listen to the DTNS, the Patreon version, including the pre and post show. And I enjoyed my mentions. They were enjoyable. And I need to talk about equity ownership of the non-entity that is text message.
Yeah, exactly. I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
Oh, I got it.
It was quite good fun. Yeah. I can't even remember the context now. How did it even come up?
I can't remember either.
I'll have to have a listen at some point.
Coming up next week, and this is weird to start a show by saying what isn't going to be coming up today, is stuff about the Pixel 2, Google's Pixel 2, because they're out now, and I've got a couple of them here, but really, because of my honeymoon, haven't had enough time to really do anything with them. So we're going to cover that next week. There are plenty of reviews online if you want to talk about or read about what people have been talking about the Pixel. But I was on the CNET UK podcast this week talking about the Pixel 2 and a variety of other tech topics with Andy Hoyle. So listen to that. It's out now. I can't remember the title, but it'll be the one that was released on Friday just gone. So check that out. And we'll be talking about the Pixel next week. Instead of talking about things we're not going to talk about this week, how about we talk about something we are going to talk about this week, Ian?
Good shout, man. Good shout.
Well, some smartwatches designed for children have security flaws, apparently, that make them vulnerable to hackers, a watchdog has learned, according to the BBC this week. The watchdog in question is the Norwegian Consumer Council, which tested watches from brands including Gator and GPS for Kids. The Beeb reported that the NCC said it discovered that attackers could track, eavesdrop, or even communicate with the wearers, which obviously is a very big problem, given the wearers are predominantly children. The manufacturers involved have insisted the problems have either already been resolved or are being addressed. Now, you may wonder, why is this a story for a UK-focused tech podcast? Well, the repercussions are already being felt in Britain, because The Telegraph reported that in response to this discovery, or rather this report from the watchdog, giant retailer John Lewis, which stocks Gator watches, has removed them from sale. It said that... It removed them from the website, but I think crucial to mention is that Gator, of which they make the watches that John Lewis stocked, the one the NCC tested is not the one that John Lewis stocked, but a spokesperson for John Lewis said, as a precautionary measure, we've withdrawn from sale all Gator smartwatch products while we await further advice and reassurance from the supplier. So this is a big issue, I think, because these sorts of technologies are more predominantly now being used for kids to be spied upon by their parents. And I use spied upon actually in a nice sense. It's a security device at heart. You know, they're designed often for children who are maybe too young to have a smartphone. You know, there's an app that parents will have on their phone that allows them to look at where the child is, you know, make sure they get to school okay. But they also have features like SOS buttons. So if they're, you know, in a problem, they can press an SOS button. And I think they either make a call or they send the GPS location to the parent's app. And they can also create... like they can't make calls from them necessarily as you know, freely, but they can have sort of certain numbers pre-programmed, you know, mum and dad or grandparents or an uncle or something, that they can sort of press a button and it will call them. So they're a good idea in some ways in principle, but apparently easily exploitable. Now, Ian, I don't have kids, but you have a pair of kids.
I do.
Would
have a pair of kids.
You use or do you use any of these types of technologies with them?
It's not relevant for us yet because my kids are too young to be anywhere without us anyway. So apart from, I mean, obviously Izzy's at school and, well, so is Bob. But for the most part, that, you know, there's very few worries there because they're not leaving without supervision and they're, you know, we know where they are at any given minute. But I've got friends who've got older kids. I've got one particular friend who I went to university with, and he was asking me about, you know, this kind of thing. You know, what watch can I get that will allow me to track him when he's out on his bike and stuff like that. And I was like, you know, I mean, I can totally appreciate it. And it's never, well, I mean, I'm sure for some parents it is, but it's never comes across as being sort of overbearing and creepy. It's really just kind of like, I would like to know that if I haven't heard from you or something, I can check. And, you know, and if you're in a weird place, then that would be something to worry about. But at the same time, you know, like it could just be, you know, are they on their way home now, kind of thing? When should I expect them? Yeah, I like the idea of it, and I think it's a really good use of technology. But of course, there's no excuse for these devices to have shoddy security. It's just unthinkable to me that you would design a device like this and make it even slightly possible for people to get in and sort of, you know, I mean, the stuff they're talking about is quite alarming, really. And it would be alarming if it was an adult's device, but it's not. It's a kid's device, and that makes it even more alarming. And, you know, being able to communicate with the people wearing it, I know that's bad. That's really bad. So I don't know. I think what needs to happen is someone, you know, like a big brand needs to be sort of responsible for doing a device where you can trust them. I mean, you could give your kids an Apple Watch. Obviously, it's extremely expensive. But, you know, I mean, I guess if Apple built that functionality in, you would probably trust Apple, wouldn't you?
Yeah,
or even
absolutely.
Android Wear, to be honest. Like, I mean, you know, if there was a sort of a set of apps you could install on an Android Wear watch that would give you that functionality, that might be better. But who knows? It's difficult. And of course, they all have to have 4G built in, so that's not exactly easy, or 3G or whatever. So, you know, it's a big problem. But the tech is something that parents ask for a lot, and I've had a lot of conversations with parents about it. So I think there's a need for it, and it needs to be done well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the products themselves are very, very interesting too, because they're designed for this use specifically. You know, they have a SIM card built in that can connect to multiple mobile networks, and they can also roam, which means it's not like you're just confined to using them in Britain.
Yeah.
If you were overseas in Europe, let's say, then, you know, they're still going to work. That's you know, I think quite a key thing as well. And I think when I was researching the story, I remember seeing one Amazon review for one of the products that said that, you know, they can be used quite effectively for adults with learning difficulties. One person said that it was actually a really useful piece of technology to have for those people because they're incredibly easy to use. And if that person does get into trouble or gets lost somehow, then all the functionality designed for children can actually be equally effective for an adult. So I think it's good that these things exist. And I think it's a shame that, you know, they're getting some bad press for this. But at the end of the day, if bad press helps improve the products and security, then overall, maybe that's a good thing. You know, we've certainly not had, we've not had reports that these have been hacked and children have been kidnapped.
No.
You know, that's not happening. So it's more a vulnerability that can now be addressed.
I don't think that's really how kidnapping works anyway. I mean, if that was actually a thing, that's almost certainly not the way. I assume that kidnappings are not usually, not in this country at least, not targeted, are they? They're opportunistic attempts at, you know, whatever. And so it's not like, I don't think this would necessarily make people a target. It's just creepy that the security isn't good enough to protect the users.
Yeah. Well, let us know if you've used one of these products or if you would use one with your kids, because I think there's some real value in understanding why people may or may not want to use this. So it'd be great to hear some examples. podcast@nateslangston.com. Well, this story broke just before we started recording today. The BBC had this story. Vodafone, EE and Three are apparently continuing to charge customers for the mobile phones that their customers buy as part of a contract, even after the cost of the handset has been paid off, according to research from Citizens Advice. Now, part of me wants to say, well, obviously... but apparently, this is big news to everybody. Citizens Advice found that customers who do not take out a new contract are paying an average of £22 extra a month. This is after the period of time that covers the cost of the handset. The government said that mobile firms need to do more to inform customers when they've paid for their handsets. The operators have said that their billing systems are fair. Vodafone in particular, which I picked out here because I'm a customer and can attest to this, says... That wherever possible, we contact customers nearing the end of their contract to offer them a range of options. These include being able to upgrade their handset, receiving an extra allowance to enhance their existing plan, or if they choose, a SIM-only plan. Now, I've had that. I've had Vodafone call me and say, hey, you're coming up to the end of your plan. Here's what you can do to renew, because they want to lock you into another 12 or 16 or 18 or months or whatever. So I've experienced that. The problem is... Ian.
I'm so glad to be out of that 18-month grind, I've got to say. Because when I started phones, I was on 12-month contracts, and I could just about live with that. 2 years is too much life to give up, as far as I'm concerned.
I agree completely. And there are, you know, there are networks and you know, plans you can get that let you upgrade every year, but it's an added premium on top of the...
Oh, yeah, and it's not cheap either. I mean, what's that iPhone package? It's like 50-odd quid a month, isn't it?
It's quite a lot. I mean, I think O2 Refresh, I think that's what they do with that. There are a range of these options. But the fact remains that if you look at the amount of money you pay for a phone as part of a contract, not the upfront cost, but the amount you pay over a period of time, you're talking probably like double the cost of the phone or something ridiculous. Like,
do you think it is that much? Because when I've looked into this, I've looked at the cost of buying a phone outright and I've looked at the cost of a tariff and all that kind of stuff. And the conclusion I reached most of the time was that it wasn't that much of a saving to buy the phone. It was a saving, but I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say double, but I don't know.
I would imagine it is something like that. So let's do a little live experiment, shall we? So I'm on the Vodafone website, iPhone 8 Plus, 5.5-inch display. I'm going to choose this. I'm going to go for a black one. I'm going to go for the 64.
No, you want the gold one, mate.
The hypothetical man in me thinks this is irrelevant.
Well, that hypothetical man is an idiot. Get the gold one.
Right, pink. I'm going to pick the black one. I'm going to pick 64 gig because let's be fair about things. Now, the cheapest contract I can get this for on Vodafone as a brand new customer on a 24-month, two-year contract, it's £60 up front for the device and £58 a month, right? 58 quid.
Blimey!
Right.
So 58 quid a month.
So if we do 58 multiplied by 24, because it's £58 a month, you're paying £1,392 over the course of that contract period for your phone. Now we go to Apple and we're going to go to apple.com/UK, and we're going to pull up iPhone 8, and we're going to see how much it costs unlocked. So this is obviously without a contract.
That's six, isn't it about 650 quid or something?
So iPhone 8 Plus, I'll pick the same one. I'm going to pick black.
Oh, no, it's the Plus. It's more than that.
And I'm picking 64 gigabytes. Brand new, that's 800 quid.
Right.
So 800 quid to buy the phone new.
Yeah.
And 58, and how much did we say?
Yeah.
1,400 quid over right. the cost of 2 years. Now,
okay, but now you need to do that. What's the tariff on its own?
Exactly. Obviously. So now what we have to do is we have to go for a SIM-only deal. And what we want is to get the...
How much data did you have on that?
That was a four gigabytes.
Right.
Four gigabytes. Outright, yeah. So,
well, it's not because I'm on an unlimited data tariff. But
yeah, well, I'm looking here, and they don't actually do a SIM-only four gigabyte plan, but they do have a 2 gigabyte plan or an 8 gigabyte plan. So if we take, just for anecdotal fun here,
I would say go for the 8 gig.
8 gig, okay. Let's go for the 8 gig plan. So you're actually getting more for this. That's £17 a month.
Right. Well, that's pretty reasonable, actually.
It is, yeah. So if you take 17, multiply that by 24,
yeah,
that's £408.
Right.
Added on to 800 quid is about 1,200 quid.
1,200, yeah. So it's about £200 difference.
So a £200 difference. However, to be perfectly honest, that was also one done with a 12-month contract on the SIM.
Right.
So if you did it, I think, for...
Month by month, it would be more expensive.
Month by month, which you probably would, because why would you tie yourself into a SIM-only contract?
Absolutely not. I mean, well, because you save some money, basically. But I think most people sort of accept that they're probably not going to want to move in 12 months.
Well, they have a 5-gigabyte plan here.
Okay. Well, that's probably a bit fairer.
Yeah, 5-gigabyte plan with 500 minutes. The other one had unlimited minutes.
Is that month by month, 30 days?
That's 30 days, yeah. So
who is billing minutes these days, for God's sake?
Oh, my goodness. Well, if you ever go out and make any calls or something outside of your allowance on a Vodafone contract, be in for a hell. It's £6 per 250 meg of data, for one thing.
My God.
I know. And a cost to like a, you know, 0345 number, or what would be a local rate on a BT landline, is something like 50p a minute.
Okay, well, so to tie this, so basically the pricing isn't as big difference as you suggested, is it? It's really actually quite modest.
Well, when you factor in the cost of the contract as well, you're looking at somewhere between £200 and £300.
Yeah.
Additional.
And bearing in mind that means you don't have to find the money up front for the phone.
You still have to pay £60 up front for the phone, so you should really, okay. So you should really add that on to the end as well.
But you don't have to find £700, do you?
No, you don't. But you would, if we added that on, then you're also adding on something like what, £60. So it's somewhere between £350 and £450 premium.
Okay,
it's about 50% extra.
Okay, yeah.
Based on this, it's
not an outrage.
It's not an outrage. It's just that it's a fact. I think it's totally fair. My argument was, you know, isn't that that it's wrong. I don't have anything a problem with this. It's more that, you know, this is not a new thing. You know, this has been around for a long time. You are better off in
general. You're penalised for being lazy, basically. If you don't have your wits about you at the end of your contract to renegotiate it down or to change providers, then... Who's going to have it? Why is anyone wasting time on this? Is my point about the story. It's like, why is Citizens Advice and the government involving themselves in this particular problem, which isn't a problem?
To get, you know, PR onto technology podcasts.
Why not pick something that people are genuinely annoyed about?
Well, people are generally annoyed about anything that affects, you know, consumer finance, personal finance.
Yeah, but this is something that you've got complete control over. Like, this isn't something whereby... So, for example... I'm annoyed because Three made me jump to a tariff that was twice the price of my old tariff because they realised that it wasn't profitable. So I was on a £12 unlimited data tariff and they bumped it up to like 20 quid. you know, why wouldn't the government involve itself in saying, well, look, you can only increase it by X amount, or, you know, or once someone's in a contract, you can't do it, or any of the other things about mobile networks that are annoying, but not the simple fact that at the end of a contract, you either renegotiate it or you don't. I just don't understand why it's a thing. It's annoyed me from the fact that this is just down to people being lazy. We've all done it. Like, how many things have you sort of not bothered to renegotiate? I mean, like, energy, for example. It's very easy to just sit on a tariff, isn't it? But yeah. You could be saving hundreds of pounds a year.
Well, the fact is, and I've said this for a long time, that you're better off if you want a phone and you're thinking of taking out a contract and you can't afford to pay the upfront cost of the phone, you are better off by a large margin in getting a credit card with, you know, like a 20% yes. APR. Getting a credit card, putting it on your credit card, paying it off over the cost of 12 months, you'll pay probably a quarter of the yeah. total interest on that phone. Maybe, I think if you do it on like a 19 or 20% APR plan, you're talking about maybe 80 or 90 quid interest over the course of a year.
There must be some 0% cards around for new purchases.
There almost certainly are, but usually the 0% you pay off within like 60 days or something. But if you're paying off, you know, the minimum, you're paying off, you know, 1/12 every month of a year, you're going to be spending about just under 900 quid on a new iPhone instead of paying the equivalent of about 1,200 quid.
Yes.
You know, so it's worth considering. It's a weird one because you sort of think, well, that's a hell of a hassle to get a card and do all this. But the fact is, it's the way of saving money, getting what you want, you know, before you can technically afford it, but also not being locked into a contract. You can sell that phone then in 12 months' time when the new one comes out. And iPhones and Samsungs tend to hold their value quite well.
Yeah,
so
yeah, they are pretty good.
You know,
yeah,
you'll get a lot of that money back.
iPhones. Like you can resell an iPhone for a decent sum of money, yeah. or perhaps even trade it in and go to, you know, get the phone that way.
So that's some consumer advice for you all. If you've been using any of these tactics or strategies or have some alternatives to share with us about how to save money over a 2-year contract period or equivalent, let us know, podcast@nateslangston.com. Ian, this week I wrote a column for our patrons,
awesome,
who support us on one of our medium level tiers, and I thought it'd be worth talking about this topic because I think that that it's of probably quite wide interest. What happened? I titled the column "Beware the quote sync as in SYNCSINK of 4G tethering." And the reason I felt compelled to write this for our patrons,
coming off your honeymoon where you were 4G tethering,
precisely. Would you like to have a guess? Have you read this article, by the way?
Funnily enough, no, I haven't, okay. Because you haven't sent it to me and I'm not a Patreon.
That's a fair point. Well made.
But yes.
Okay. Well, the fact is, I would like you to guess how much data I used over my 7-day honeymoon recently in Wales.
7 days in a middle of nowhere with nothing to do.
I'll give you a couple of hints.
30 gig.
Let me give you a couple of hints.
Okay.
You can revise that if you wish afterwards.
Okay.
I had the... what was it? It was in... the SIM was in the iPad.
Okay.
And tethered to that was an iPhone, Kate's iPad, and her Galaxy Note 8.
Yeah, and she was gaming. And you were gaming.
She was gaming, I was gaming. And we were out most of the day.
Right. So it's just the evenings. Did you watch any Netflix?
We watched a couple of episodes of The Great British Bake Off and Dragon's Den.
Okay, let's go for 10 gig.
65 gig.
You are kidding.
65 gigabytes of data over the
week. Holy moly.
And I want to explain why, because I think...
And how much did that cost you?
Well, it was all part of the existing plan. I didn't have any overage.
Right.
Because I had an EE SIM in the iPad, and I've got... a Vodafone SIM in the iPhone. So, and the EE SIM had 60 gig on it, and my Vodafone contract, I think, has 20 gig, and I used about 5 gig of that 20 as well.
So basically, you used all of your data.
Pretty much. Yeah.
And did you get to the end and think, I could use some more, or did you just go, that's it?
No, I still had some left, but fortunately they were both very close to the end of the contract, the recycle period. So I actually got more data while I was still away, but that Excellent. Was the total I used. Why is this interesting? Well, the reason I used so much data was not because of the gaming. It wasn't really even because of the streaming of the videos. It was because of the fact that my iPhone and my iPad are both kept in perfect sync via iCloud. Nice. And what I was doing is at the end of the day, or in fact during the day, some of the time, I was taking the SD card out of my SLR camera. It's a Sony a7R II. I had it shooting in HDR at full resolution. So those JPEGs come out at about 25 meg each on average, between 20 and 25 meg.
Yep.
And I was importing those into the iPad using the SD card adapter.
Yep.
And then
good feature, that.
It's a great feature, and it gave me great peace of mind while we were away that, you know, all my honeymoon pictures weren't being stored on a SD card that could be lost or damaged or stolen. They were all being backed up onto the iPad. But then the iPad, using iOS 11, which you can use to sync your photo library now, it was then sending those photos up to iCloud. But then the iPhone was pulling those photos back down from iCloud, and any photos and videos I took on the iPhone were then syncing up to iCloud and syncing back down onto the iPad. So, you know, one photo, let's say a photo was 25 meg, would actually use 50 meg of data in total because of the two ways that it was syncing.
That's incredible.
You know, on top of that, and I turned that feature on because I have so much data on the iPad that, you know, it's worth doing for me, but that's fine. Plus, we were doing the syncing, we were loading maps, we were sending video to family and friends sometimes, you know, we were streaming from Apple Music quite a lot of the time. There was a lot of stuff we were doing, but I wanted to sort of, I didn't want to have to worry about data, and there was very poor internet in this little cabin in the middle of nowhere in Wales where we were. So, you know, I stuck the iPhone in a tree at one point. I had the iPad propped up against the glass at one point, and I just sort of set it and forget it, leave it out. But because I've been used to having, you know, very high speed fiber optic internet at home, you never worry about things like syncing and data. You know, Virgin Media told me I use over a terabyte of data a month or something on our fiber line, and it's because I've got about a billion Apple devices all kept in sync with each other. And so you never think about it. It's not until you go out on a technically a limited data plan and you leave all this stuff active, and suddenly you realize just how much data the ways that we use to sync devices to each other actually uses. And it was a real bit of a wake-up call for me, because, you know, if you'd have been on a more limited data plan, or if you were roaming or something similar, that's going to use up an awful lot of your data without you necessarily noticing in time.
It's quite, I mean, I would be interested in Apple looking into ways to, so for example, you know, you've got AirDrop. So you could sync with AirDrop, but it's not very fast, is it?
Yeah, and AirDrop, for those who don't know, is kind of like a peer-to-peer sharing system between two local devices.
I would like to see maybe Apple think about like doing something with that, where it goes, well, let's not use data if we can possibly, you know, just do it locally. Because why burden the cloud with that twice, essentially? I mean, it's okay to put it up once, but you know what, you know, why, you know, if people generally don't have unlimited data anywhere anymore, do they? Because that went away.
Yeah,
so it would be quite good for them to sort of think about that. But I mean,
I think you can do different things. I mean, you can turn that feature off, the syncing thing. And you can do the same with, you know, with drives. Is I was talking about photos, but you can do this with files as well. And you can do this even more flexibly on Android. You can do a lot of syncing on Android.
The problem is when you're tethering as well, even if you say don't do this on cellular, then you, because it looks like Wi-Fi when you're tethered, doesn't it? So that it would still do all that syncing. So it makes it a little bit harder, doesn't it?
And
you have to actually physically remember to turn the feature off entirely if you want to save data.
And that definitely happened a bit when Kate's Android phone was tethered to me, because the Apple devices know when they're tethered to each other. They actually have a different icon.
It's a proprietary system, isn't it?
It is, but that's not in place between Android and iOS. So an iOS device to an Android effectively just looks like any other Wi-Fi hotspot.
So the Apple devices don't necessarily, they don't treat it like Wi-Fi if they're connected to each other as a hotspot. So that's quite, I didn't know that actually.
I believe not. I believe not.
There's a lot of stuff about Apple that's not always that easy to know. And I kind of think, I should probably know this.
Yeah.
But actually, it's not always obvious, is it?
No, because tethering's a weird one, because tethering, often involves carrier support. You know, you actually need the network to support tethering, which I've always found very unfair, because in the day, you know, when you're on a limited data plan, it should be up to you what you want to use that data for.
True.
You know, but it stops you doing things like overseas roaming and getting into trouble, perhaps having a laptop tethered to an iPhone.
And even if you have a tethering agreement, you won't be able to do it overseas. For the most part. I don't know what the rule is with Europe with tethering. Is it included as part, if you've got it as a, so for example, on my 3 unlimited data tariff, I have 30 gigs of tethering allowed, which is pretty generous, really. But I don't imagine I could use that in Europe, could I?
I can on my Vodafone.
Interesting. I should look it up. Someone's going to email us. I probably won't look it up. Just email me. Someone out there must be on 3 and know the answers. Just tweet me or something.
If you've if you've tethered across Europe or anywhere out of your home country, because you know listeners around the world will have different views on this, let us know how it works for you, or if you've run into problems. podcast@natelangston.com. Be really interested to hear that. And, you know, it's just something we've got to be more aware of, you know, as we're increasingly using mobile data for, you know, quite heavy home-like internet usage. We're going to have to be, I think, aware of this. I think it's going to become, I don't think it'll become a problem as such, but I think it's something that people need to be thinking about a little bit, that if they're leaving their devices all on in sync, they may well, you know, be eating up data. The other thing, of course, is they can eat up battery, which is another issue if you're away from home.
Well, we had a conversation about
exactly.
This. Basically, you ordered me to turn off data sync because I was just killing my battery.
I'm not sure if I ordered you as much as I suggested it.
Yeah, I mean, I just like the idea, like you. I like the idea that every time I take a photograph, it shoots up to the cloud and is there. And I just really like that. I mean, I haven't lost a phone for... I don't think I've ever lost a phone. So it's quite unlikely I'm going to lose a phone. But even so, I'm like, I just like the security of knowing that the photos are safe. So I don't do it anymore. It is turned off still. So
if memory serves, you were using Amazon, the Amazon.
That's the thing. I'm using all of them. So all my photos go to Google, Amazon and Apple. So, you know, I mean, why? It's ridiculous. You end up with photos and you're like, I don't really want this photo. I can't get rid of it because it's in 3 places and it will just turn up again. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's like, you know, it's so out of control. But the thing is, Amazon is brilliant. It gives you unlimited photo storage for Prime, including raw files, which I absolutely love. So I'm increasingly putting all of my photos that I've ever taken on there, and it may eventually allow me to cut down some local storage because I've got a lot of raw files that I probably don't need to keep. So I could just delete all the raws for older stuff, but they'd still be on Amazon, and then they're there if I ever felt for some reason that I needed to get them back. But that service is brilliant, and of course, iCloud is so much easier for, you know, just for having an automated thing where they turn up on all your Apple devices. That's great for that. You know, it's probably I don't need to put them everywhere. And Google gives you unlimited storage for compressed images. So
If you buy a Pixel, it actually increases that to
it's unlimited.
Unlimited for even the originals.
Yes. To be honest with you, my theory on that is that although the images it says are compressed when you upload them, my theory is they still have the original and that they don't let you see it, but I suspect it's still there because I believe that's how YouTube works. I don't think that with YouTube they delete the original file.
They don't know.
So because that enables them to go back to it later, doesn't it? So if you do a 4K upload now, they might not have the ability to stream it at full quality, but in 10 years' time they can get an extra you know, because UG is actually quite crap if you look at the data rates. But you know, they're clever. So I suspect that those photos are still there in their original form.
Well, let us know any thoughts you have on the syncing and, of course, the tethering, particularly the international tethering issue that we've talked about. Let us know, podcast@nateslangson.com. And if you'd like to get the weekly columns that we post on Patreon, then maybe do consider joining us on our mid-tier, patreon.com/UK Tech. London's new electric taxis, very exciting, Ian, are almost ready for the public, according to Engadget. This is a very interestingly timed story, given all the Uber news going around in London. We've not had any more developments about that recently, by the way.
No, they nearly missed their appeal date, though, didn't they?
Well, they've
they had like 24 hours left, and then they suddenly filed it.
Often appeals are filed at the very last minute. No. But hey-ho. Six test vehicles are being introduced to the city streets this week, and this is ahead of a planned rollout later this year. Drivers who are participating in this trial are going to be helping collect data for the manufacturer about potential emission savings and, frankly, the reality, I believe, of using London's charger network, which, you know, depending on where you are, can be patchy. But the interesting thing about these vehicles is they're actually really quite good. We'd seen the new vehicle. It was called the TX5 initially in late 2015. But inside, it's a 1.3-litre, three-cylinder petrol engine, blah, blah, blah. I don't know anything about cars, but I believe that's fine. But the petrol...
It is. But it's interesting, note that they're now using petrol, not diesel, which is great.
Oh, so the current one's a diesel.
Oh, God, yeah. And that it's a huge problem. Like, same with buses, obviously, because you can't run a bus on petrol. But, they're all diesels. And, I mean, it makes sense because you're running it all day. So you need a bit of economy. And also, diesel engines are okay if they're run sort of all the time. If you're always driving around, it makes more sense. They're terrible when they're cold. But I don't know what size engine they would have been. They would have probably been like a 1.6 or a 1.9, I guess. But... you know, you if you've been in a taxi, it's not the most smooth experience, is it? So I reckon the electric will really help with that bit.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. More interesting than I thought it was in that case. And the petrol engine acts as a generator for the battery pack. And
can I tell you something about that?
Yes.
When years and years ago, Vauxhall introduced it was the Volt, wasn't it, in the US, and it's the Ampera here.
No idea.
And basically that is a car its wheels are driven electrically, I believe all the time. I think that's right. So, you know, normally an engine drives the wheels directly, but with those cars, the electric motors drive the wheels. But I said to them, so why don't you allow people to run it so that the engine is running and it's charging up the battery all the time? And they were said that that's the least efficient way of doing it. So it's interesting that they've gone for that. But I can sort of see why. But I wonder, I suppose there'll be different modes, basically, because you could either run it so that you do your 70 miles on a charge and then it's flat and then you go and plug in and have some lunch and then you get back in it and you do another 70 miles. I don't know what a cab driver does in a day. If there's anyone listening, that'd be quite interesting to know, actually. But of course, electric cars don't use power when they're stationary. So, you know, it's not like if you're waiting for fares, you have to worry about that. But it would be interesting to sort of, like, you know, the idea of using it with a petrol engine. Like, it would be so much cheaper for taxi drivers to just do it electrically and charge up rather than running the little petrol motor. But, you know, it's an interesting idea, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But other features that this has, and this is where we get more to the tech aspect. Well, one bit that isn't so much tech, if it's running as a pure EV electric vehicle, it can do about 70 miles on a single charge, which doesn't seem very much for a taxi that's going to be going around London all day. But with the petrol assistance, that rises to 400 miles. So it's classed as a zero emissions capable vehicle, even if it's not actually emitting zero fumes itself. Yeah. It's kind of tries to be the best of both worlds without actually being fully one or the other. But the tech side on the inside, six-seater, by the way, it's got contactless card machine in it, which has been a mandatory requirement of all of these taxis in London since last year. It also has onboard Wi-Fi, and USB charging. Drivers are going to have a sat nav up front built in with information about traffic congestion, the nearest electric charging locations, as well as integration with taxi hailing apps like Get, My Taxi, and Cabbie, which are the most popular ones here in London, other than Uber, to help drivers obviously compete with Uber. So they've really stepped it up. Like there are no vehicles like this in a taxi I've ever been in. Most taxis I've ever been in they're not exactly high tech anywhere in the world.
But you've got to appreciate that those taxis are perfectly designed for doing the job they do in London. That their turning circle is such that you can, you know, turn in pretty much any street. All the drivers all know exactly how big the car is, so you know you'll never see them doing like a 15 point turn because they're just perfectly designed for London. And yeah, they're not the most comfortable things in the world, but I guess most journeys are like, you know, 10 minutes, 2 miles at the most, I guess.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. But, you know, I mean, we've got to do something. I probably, like a lot of people, was just not aware of how bad the air in London is. And it's not too bad. You don't feel like it's bad when you're there, but from a particulate point of view, it's a disaster and it needs to be sorted out quite fast. And I guess one of the ways to do that is to take off as many of the cabs as possible. You know, they're doing a scrappage scheme as well. So all new taxis from January 2018 must be hybrid. I don't know if they have to be petrol or if they just have to be like capable of being driven electrically. And then they're doing like a scrappage scheme where cabs up to 10 years old can be taken off the road early and you get a rebate on TFL is giving drivers a rebate on a new cab because they're obviously monstrously expensive.
Yeah.
And obviously it's a good way of getting those cars off the road because we should have hybrids. It's one of the good things that Uber did do is, you know, most of those drivers are in hybrid cars.
Yeah, it's a prime. You know,
as much as the black cabbies hate them, it's better.
Well, let us know any thoughts you have, of course. podcast@nateslangson.com. Well, that's it for the news this week. We did have some others that we didn't get to that we did tweet out on @textmessagepod, which is where we tweet all of the news through the week that we may discuss at the weekend. And obviously, it's another way for you to get in touch with opinions or replies for those stories. We tweeted but didn't talk about news about the BlackBerry Motion, a sort of slightly rugged phone coming to UK stores, which I don't think anybody else noticed. And why would you?
I just love the way you've described it in the thing. It sort of lurches onto UK shores.
Yeah, well, I can't take credit for that, unfortunately. That was actually the headline from the Register.
Right. Yeah, well, that's very Register, isn't it?
It is, yeah. UK government could force petrol stations to install EV chargers, which is interesting because I know Shell has been installing a few EV chargers at some of its stations.
So it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, come on.
Yeah. So those are just a couple of stories that we tweet out. So do follow us on @textmessagepod for just to keep up through the week with the UK-specific tech news that matters. In the mailbag this week, firstly, I just wanted to say thank you to the many, many people who have written in or tweeted with kind words about my recent wedding. So thank you very much. We really should tweet maybe a couple of pictures out or something of you and I at the wedding because there's some very nice ones of us getting ready.
I said I was
ready.
Going to do it, and then I just decided to have loads of fun instead.
Yes.
I didn't send a single tweet.
Well, I have evidence of that fun. so I'll be...
Good. Some good photos, actually, weren't there, from all of the sources.
I think we'll tweet a couple of those out after the show goes out, maybe post some on the Patreon as well. But this email came in after we talked about paperless travel, contactless payments and things. And we'd sort of asked if anybody had examples of alternatives that their local community uses, like we have Oyster in London and Tokyo has Suica card and things like that. Richard Aldroyd wrote in and said, regarding paperless travel, I regularly use my Walrus card. I love that name, Walrus.
Yeah.
Issued by Mersey Travel to travel to work. So this is, I presume, in Merseyside. The Walrus card, it works a lot like the London Oyster card. You can use it for bus, for ferries, and for the train, and you top it up at a pay point, like a lot of people use to top up mobile phones and pay bills and things. But it seems to work. It works the same. It's not just us in London that have the contactless thing. And apparently, they can also use the bus company app on Android, which is the Arriva. Arriva service or Arriva.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how you pronounce it.
I think it's Arriva.
I think it's Arriva as well. But you can use that as well, and you know, you've got your sort of tickets on the device. So
yeah,
it's great. So let us know any more comments you have or thoughts. podcast@natelangson.com. Before we end the show, let's check in with Tom Merritt, who's now safely nestled back in his Los Angeles studio. Tom, what has been going on this week since the wedding?
Thanks, Nate. This week on DTNS, we covered what you do and don't need to worry about regarding the crack Wi-Fi vulnerability, debated whether we need a nice web, discussed why it is the coffee shop noise bothers people less than office noise, and I think I hit on Netflix's next wave of business strategy. Plus, we evaluated Twitter's calendar of safety changes. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thank you, Tom, mate. Great. Well, I think that just leaves us to say that if you haven't listened to Ian and Tom do the live Daily Tech News show, do go and check it out. Tom Checks Into London is the show at DailyTechNewsShow.com. It was from, what date would it have been? It would have been the day after
your wedding.
Yeah, the 9th of October, I think. So go and listen to that show. It's a lot of fun. It's great to hear Ian and Tom in a live setting. And our friend Will Harris, of course.
Yes,
I used to work with for a number of years.
He's another one we've talked about getting on the show, so we must sort that out as well, mustn't we?
I think so, yeah. We'll get him on. We'll get Westaway on. Hell, we'll probably get Tom on again soon. Get all the podcasters on.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, thank you again to our patrons supporting us. Please do give us a shout, give us a try, rather, at patreon.com/UKTech. You can support us from as little as $1 a week. Frankly, that's a big part of the reason why we're still around and still able to do extra stuff for patrons is we've got a lovely community of people who are able to support us over there. There's no commitment, of course. You can try us for a week or a month or something and cancel if you wish. But I hope you could give us a try. And if you aren't able to do that, then thank you just for listening and for telling your friends and family, for leaving us fantastic reviews in iTunes and other app stores. That helps us just as much keep the show alive. So thank you in whatever way you're supporting us. And I think on that note, Ian, we'll see them. Let me check here. I think
he's checking his diary.
Calendar. Next week, mate. Next
yes.
week.
Yes.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.